From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I refuse to give up on any child, and the No Child Left Behind Act is opening the door of opportunity to all of America's children.
Today, we take a look at the Bush administration and education.
The No Child Left Behind Act is not a law for solving a crisis in public education. It's a tool for creating one. Public schools need a very different toolkit.
No Child Left Behind, or is it No Bush Left Behind? When you're barred from banking, why not bank on education? We'll take a look at President Bush's younger brother, Neil Bush, and how he profits from the education industry. But first, we go to Madrid, after the series of bombings, the death toll is mounting. Stay with us. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Madrid, the death toll has risen to at least 198 in Thursday's train bombings. Officials say 10 bombs ripped through four trains at the height of rush hour, killing nearly 200 and wounding at least 1,400. The bombings all occurred within 10 minutes of each other. Newspapers in Madrid described the day as Spain's 9-1-1. It was the deadliest bombing in Europe since 1988. When 270 people died in the Lockerbie airline explosion. Spanish officials immediately assumed the Basque separatist group ETA was behind the attack, but evidence later emerged that forced officials to investigate a possible al-Qaeda role. An Arabic newspaper in London received a letter from a group with ties to al-Qaeda claiming responsibility. But the letter was viewed with skepticism because the same group had also taken responsibility for last year's massive blackout along the East Coast. A truck containing detonators and an Arabic Quran was found. The attack came exactly 2.5 years, or 911 days, after the September 11th attacks in New York and Washington. Spain has begun 3 days of mourning. Schools, museums, and the central bank have all been shut down. Millions are expected to participate in rallies to mourn the dead. The Bush administration's top expert on Medicare costs told colleagues last summer he would be fired if he revealed that the actual cost of the pending Medicare prescription drug plan was far more expensive than the White House was acknowledging. This according to a report by Knight Ritter. When the White House passed the bill in November, the White House said the program would cost just under $400 billion over the next decade. But since then, the White House has revised the estimate to upwards of $150 billion more. It's widely assumed the Medicare bill would not have passed Congress if legislators knew the program's actual cost. The White House had known the program would likely cost about $550 billion based on calculations by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Before the congressional vote, the center's chief Medicare actuary, Richard Foster, wrote an email to friends saying he would be fired if he revealed the higher estimate. Foster was also barred from answering questions about the bill's cost. A British man who was held on Guantanamo Bay by U.S. forces has told the Daily Mirror of London that he was beaten and tortured while being detained by the United States. The man, Jamal al-Harith, said prisoners were kicked, punched, and assaulted with batons. They were kept in hand and leg shackles with metal links into the skin for up to 15 hours at a time, he said. Prostitutes were brought into the camp and paraded around naked in front of the devout Muslims, he said. He accused the U.S. of subjecting him to psychological torture in an effort to break him. He also said they were given food rations that were 10 years out of date. The U.S. rejected the claims, saying they are completely untrue. The U.S. is currently detaining over 600 men at Guantanamo Bay. None of them have been charged with a crime and are living in a legal black hole where the United States claims they have no rights under either U.S. or international law. The California Supreme Court has unanimously ordered San Francisco to stop marrying same-sex couples until the court rules on the legality of the city's actions. Since February 12th, over 4,100 same-sex couples have received marriage licenses, and other cities around the country have followed suit. The court's action left the new marriages intact, at least, but in jeopardy. According to the Los Angeles Times, the court will decide a fairly narrow question, whether San Francisco officials had the authority to deem a state law unconstitutional. Meanwhile, in Massachusetts, the state legislature gave preliminary approval Thursday to an amendment to the state constitution banning same-sex marriage but establishing civil unions for gay couples. President Bush spoke out against same-sex marriages again last night, speaking before the National Convention of the National Association of Evangelicals. According to the New York Times, the group of 30 million evangelicals is well aware of its clout in Washington. A slogan on the back of the convention program read, quote, "What can 30 million evangelicals do for America? Anything we want." In campaign news, President Bush launched his first negative ads yesterday, attacking John Kerry, claiming he's weak on terrorism and would raise taxes by at least $900 billion. Kerry challenged the claims. Writing in the Washington Post, media critic Howard Kurtz said the ads have, quote, plunged the presidential campaign into a more negative finger-pointing phase at an unusually early juncture 8 months before Election Day. A second cousin of President Bush's chief of staff, Andrew Card, has been arrested on charges she spied for the Iraqi government. The woman, Susan Lindauer, was taken into custody by the FBI after she was charged with acting as an agent for the Iraqi intelligence service. Government officials said Lindauer accepted $10,000 from Iraq, traveled to Baghdad, and delivered a letter from the Iraqi government to Andrew Card before the invasion in an apparent attempt to stop the attack. As she was being led out of a courthouse yesterday, she said, quote, "I've done good things for this country. I worked to get the weapons inspectors back to Iraq. When everybody said it was impossible, I worked to do it, and I'm very proud, and I will very proudly stand by my achievements. I'm an anti-war activist, and I'm innocent. I've done more to stop terrorism in this country than anybody else," she said. Lindauer used to write for Fortune and U.S. News and World Reports and worked as an aide to several Capitol Hill legislators, including Senator Carol Mosley Braun and Oregon Democratic Congress members Peter DeFazio and Ron Wyden. The Washington Times is reporting a U.S. Navy strategic missile was damaged during a mishap at a submarine base last year and came within inches of striking a nuclear warhead. The incident occurred at a submarine base near Silverdale, Washington. Tulane University has announced it'll no longer sell off its oversupply of cadavers that had been donated to science after it was revealed that a cadaver broker had sold the bodies to the U.S. military. The military then blew up the cadavers in landmine experiments. And finally, in environmental news, Swiss scientists have determined that Europe suffered its hottest summer in 500 years last year. Researchers at the University of Switzerland reported, quote, "an exceptionally strong, unprecedented warming trend."
Hey, we shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Darling,
Springsteen, "We Shall Overcome." This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to our listeners, viewers around the country, and to those of you around the world on the internet. In Madrid, the death toll has risen to at least 198 in Thursday's train bombings. Officials say 10 bombs ripped through four trains in the space of just 3 minutes at the height of rush hour. Over 1,400 are wounded, and the death toll is expected to rise, with 60 of the wounded in serious state. The harrowing task of identifying dozens of bodies is continuing more than 24 hours after the blast. Newspapers in Madrid are describing the attacks as Spain's 9-1-1. Witnesses describe scenes of horror with trains crushed like, quote, cans of tuna, while mobile phones rang eerily from the pockets of the dead. Spain has begun 3 days of mourning. Millions are expected to participate in rallies tonight to mourn the dead. Schools, museums, and the central bank have all been shut down.
Spanish officials immediately assumed the Basque separatist group ETA was behind the attack. The group has previously targeted the Spanish railway system, and two ETA suspects were arrested last month driving a truckload, truck loaded with more than 500 kilograms of explosives headed for Madrid. But evidence later emerged that forced officials to investigate a possible al-Qaeda role. First, a van was discovered near the train station with detonators and Arabic material inside. Then an Arabic newspaper in London received a letter from a group with ties to al-Qaeda claiming responsibility, saying, quote, "We've succeeded in infiltrating the heart of a crusader Europe and struck one of the bases of the crusader alliance." But the letter was viewed with skepticism, for the same group had also taken responsibility for last year's massive blackout along the east coast of the United States.
Spanish editorial writers are demanding answers before voters go to the polls in Sunday's general election, because the culprit's identity might influence people's choice of which party to vote for. The ruling Popular Party campaigned on a hardline stance against ETA, but it also defied popular opposition by supporting the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, which many say could have triggered an attack by al-Qaeda.
We go directly to Madrid right now to speak with Jeff Pingree of the Christian Science Monitor. You've just been out on the streets. What is happening right now, Jeff?
Hi, Amy. Well, it's raining today, and you'd think that might dampen people's enthusiasm, but it hasn't. I just came back from the Puerta del Sol, which is one of the main plazas in Madrid, and it's filled with mostly young people, students. We talked to several there, many who had come in from small towns on buses to participate, and it's a very, very active show of solidarity. The traffic is pretty much congested everywhere, and you don't see the usual goings-on, people going to businesses or unusual activities. They tend to be gathered in central places, either gathered in silence or protesting, carrying signs, no ETA, no terrorism, some taking particular positions on the political parties for the elections. But the thing that's most striking is the unified sense of people looking at this as something that's very different and is at the front of everyone's minds.
Jeff, is there any indication that they're any closer to trying to figure out who was responsible for the attacks?
Well, it's interesting. In the news lead that you just gave, that pretty much captures, I think, what is generally known. Since yesterday, the Ministry of Interior of the Popular Party government came out and very blatantly pointed to ETA and blamed them and said without any doubt that's who did it, that set up a kind of conflict that today is sort of come apart. He's since held news conferences and recanted that, and today the president of the government and of the Popular Party, Aznar, was on television for a long time and then a press conference, and he talked about how it was appropriate for his interior minister yesterday to make those claims based on the evidence they had, but that now the government was looking at all sides. I think that there's a lot of, depending on how people want to push the issue, there's a lot of speculation about the nature of those so-called Arabic materials that were in the van. I think one was an Arabic language tape, but seems to be something that would be easily purchased or duplicated, so it's hard to see that as authentic evidence. And the president today, Aznar, in his comments, made gestures that are interesting in terms of how people might be feeling. He identified all the different countries who had victims in the blast yesterday, and then said that his government was going to naturalize all victims and members of their family, including those injured, as Spanish citizens, which goes right to the heart of the immigration issues that are fairly contentious here in the elections, and I think goes to a lot of the conflicts people have about whether the government is inclusive or exclusive.
Well, Jeff Pingree, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Jeff Pingree speaking to us from Madrid about the series of bomb attacks that have taken place yesterday that at this point have led to the deaths of almost 200 people, 1,400 people have been wounded. As we turn now to a major national issue, and that is the issue of education. Juan?
Yes, so Massachusetts Senator John Kerry and President George W. Bush have quite a few things in common. They both went to Yale. They are both members of the Skull and Bone Society. Bush invaded Iraq and Kerry supported him. The president proposed the Patriot Act. Kerry voted for it. Bush pushed through the No Child Left Behind Act, and John Kerry voted for that as well. In fact, the things that united Kerry with Bush were the major points of contention with his former rival, Governor Howard Dean. Today on the program, we're going to take an extensive look at one of these issues, the No Child Left Behind Act.
It's become one of the most contentious policies of the Bush presidency. Bush considers it to be his crowning achievement in education policy, saying it'll improve America's schools. Critics, mainly parents and teachers who are opposed to privatizing education, say it's about shifting resources from public schools to corporations. In a moment, we'll have a debate on the No Child Left Behind Act, but first we're going to take a look at who's profiting and who stands to profit.
We'll begin by looking at the Bush family itself. Everyone knows the president's brother Jeb is the governor of Florida, but less well known is his second youngest brother, Neil Bush. Years ago, he hit the front pages for his role in the savings and loan scandal. He was a director of the Silverado Savings and Loan when it collapsed in 1988, costing taxpayers more than $1 billion. As a result, he was banned from banking activities. So when Neil Bush was banned from banking, he banked on education.
In October 2001, shortly after the United States began bombing Afghanistan, Neil attended an international technology conference in Dubai. He was fishing for investors for his latest business venture, Ignite Inc. Incorporated, an interactive education software company that he founded in March 99. Ignite says its goal is to help students improve their standardized test scores, and that's where No Child Left Behind comes into play. Neil Bush's company sells software to prepare students to take comprehensive tests required under No Child Left Behind. Schools that fail the tests will face termination of federal assistance. The contracts for these test programs are very lucrative. Ignite is currently running a pilot program at a middle school in Orlando, Florida, where Neil's brother Jeb is governor. The company hopes to sell the software throughout Florida at $30 per pupil per year. In mid-February, Houston school board members unanimously agreed to accept $115,000 in charitable donations that would be funneled to Ignite. The Houston Independent School District trustees had initially delayed a vote on the matter in December, saying they were concerned that Bush's Austin-based company might be benefiting from his family name. But in February, the nine board members approved the funding without discussion. We turn first to Ron Nesimoff of the Houston Chronicle. Can you tell us more about Neil Bush's company, Ignite, how it got started, and what is the latest?
Hi. One of the things that, it certainly raises a lot of questions about whether he's benefiting from his family name, but he claims that he's doing this because it's a lifelong passion of his. He was dyslexic when he attended middle school himself. He always had trouble in school, even though he ended up getting an MBA from Tulane University. And then when his youngest son, I think his name is Pierce, but I'm not sure, had a similar problem with dyslexia, he decided that it was time for him to, you know, become active in this issue, and he formed this company in 1999. And one thing that you mentioned, even though the company could potentially profit from the No Child Left Behind accountability movement, he says that this company was not founded on the basis of helping students pass tests. It was founded basically as a curriculum-based a software company that enhances the curriculum. Schools are using it to try to help kids pass tests, but that he says that's not why he founded the company.
And obviously, since he didn't have any direct experience in this kind of educational work before, who else are partners with him or investors in the company?
He seems to have assembled a pretty good team of educational experts. The president of his company is somebody named Ken Leonard, who's done a lot of educational work in Austin, Texas. He was a principal of a private institution, I think. The investors are certainly a different matter. He has gotten quite a bit of investment from, you know, overseas people, oil magnates, the Taiwanese software company Tycoon, who also gave him $2 million to be a consultant for the software company. I have talked to other software developers who say that they would have no ability to raise money like that from people not connected directly to the educational industry. So it certainly raises a lot of eyebrows as why these people are donating money to Bush and whether they're trying to get some kind of access to the White House. And also some, you know, he's raised money from some GOP investors as well, and also from the first President Bush and his wife Barbara.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. We're talking to Ron Nisimoff of the Houston Chronicle, and we are talking about the No Child Left Behind Act, with a particular focus in this segment on the younger brother of George Bush, not as well known as Jeb Bush, his Florida governor brother, but Neil Bush, who runs Ignite. Stay with us. Subject in School, Burning Spear, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we look at the No Child Left Behind Act and now look at Ignite, George Bush's younger brother, Neil Bush's company. We are joined by Bill Berkowitz, columnist for WorkingForChange.com. You have been following Neil Bush's company, Ignite. Can you fill out what Ron Nisimoff of the Houston Chronicle was just telling us?
Well, good morning. Neil Bush is, I think, one of the bounce-back boys, the Bush brothers. He, along with Jeb and George W., was before Silverado, had intended to run for governor of Colorado. But that was, of course, put aside when Silverado happened. The Ignite experience is, I think, fascinating because it grows out of several trips to the Middle East and raising money there in the Middle East for the venture.
Can you talk about that?
Well, in January 2002, he visited Saudi Arabia, and a visit that was sponsored by the Saudi Bin Laden Construction Group, and also the Prince Alawad bin Talal. He was the fellow who offered $10 million to help the victims of the World Trade Center that Mayor Rudy Giuliani turned down. And he had made several trips to the Middle East throughout the early 90s. In fact, after his father left office, he went and lobbied the Kuwaitis for some Enron dealings. So he's, and in fact, just the other day, when he recently remarried last week, there were several Saudi Arabian guests at the wedding.
Well, we're also joined on the phone by Peter Carlson, a staff writer with the Washington Post, who wrote a very interesting article late last year on Neil Bush. Welcome to Democracy Now.
Hi, how are you?
Peter, can you tell us a little more about this this trip out to the Middle East that that Neil took, and also why would companies or investors in Saudi Arabia, China, other places want to invest in a United States software company?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure they're rushing to invest in anybody else's American software companies. He's been to the Middle East many times as a guest of the Saudis, guests of some high-ranking Egyptians. The Bush family has a lot of friends in the Middle East, and Neil has no compunctions about trading on those friendships to get investments for his company.
Can you talk further about these relationships? Of course, we know that the Bush family in general, George Bush Sr., as well as the president, have very close ties to Saudi Arabia, have actually gotten gotten millions of dollars from the Saudis. But Neil Bush goes beyond with China as well.
Yeah, for Ignite, Neil Bush has gotten investment from Kuwait, from the United Arab Emirates, from the British Virgin Islands, from Taiwan, from Japan. He's got a lot of contacts all over the world, and they treat him very well over there, as has been widely publicized during his trips to the Far East in Hong Kong and Thailand. He would be sitting in his hotel room minding his own business when there would be a knock at the door, and a lovely young lady would be there and come in and have sex with him. He testified he had no idea who they were or why they came or who sent them. They obviously treat him very well overseas.
Well, he's not the first president's relative to cash in on connections to the presidency. Obviously, Bill Clinton's brother, and it was a famous Jimmy Carter's brother. I mean, this is a long time tradition of relatives cashing in on their proximity to the presidency. Is his any different from some of these past examples?
Well, he has managed to do something that no other presidential relative has ever done before, and that is embarrass two presidential relatives. He embarrassed his father with his shenanigans in the Silverado savings and loan scandal, and now he's managing to embarrass his brother with these activities overseas. So nobody's ever done that before. He's also a little more of a slick businessman than Billy Carter. Billy Carter took $200,000 from the Libyans for God knows what, but Neil has taken much more than that from a wide variety of sources.
Maybe if we could go back to Silverado, this idea of banned from banking, now banking on education. Bill Berkowitz, if you can take us back to look at Neil Bush's record and then forward with this educational company and his involvement with the whole educational software lobbying in Washington.
Well, the Silverado case was, both George and Neil have been the products of failed business deals with high-powered connections. Only with Neil, it cost the taxpayers well over $1 billion. His relationships with a couple of Denver real estate high rollers, Bill Walters and Ken Good, wound up costing the taxpayers over $1 billion. And that was followed by, interestingly enough, by a deal with after Silverado, he started up a company called Apex Energy, and that wound up costing the taxpayers money also, because one of the investors, who was a Bush family friend, Lewis Marks, wound up getting money from the Small Business Administration. So not only did Neil fail in several business deals earlier in his career, but those failures wound up costing the taxpayers money. This time, one of the deals that he's got that one of the guests referred to is this arrangement with Grace Semiconductor through a Chinese company that is controlled in part by the son of the former Chinese president, Jiang Zemin. Here, Bush, Neil claims that he hasn't yet received any of the $2 million that he has been promised because supposedly it comes after he attends these board meetings, and he hasn't yet done that. So I think what one of your guests previously said, he's managed to leverage all these different relationships and pull them together with Ignite. Now, someone in the an education official has said that thus far there have not been any connections to Ignite from the federal government in terms of contracts. But as Neil has said, and as you know, the Bush family is a family that never bothers to say you're sorry about nearly anything. He says, well, George W. is his brother, and he's not beholden to that relationship, and anything that he gains will be done on his own merit.
I'd like to get back to this issue of Ignite, and that you mentioned, actually the Houston Chronicle reporter who spoke with us before mentioned that although Ignite is basically a software company and is not related to the testing systems that are now being triggered by No Child Left Behind, it is clear that President Bush's policies are having an enormous impact on the ability of both testing companies and software companies to get into the public schools with huge contracts. And that's why I'm a little puzzled about why all these foreign corporations are suddenly taking an interest in public education or in using software for public education. Could you comment on that?
Well, I think we can only speculate. And as Peter, I think, said pretty clearly, God knows why these companies want to get involved. But this is a family that... as Kevin Phillips has written about in American Dynasty, that is so tied up with Middle East interests that it took his book, and it'll take several more to unravel the puzzle here. But it's clear that Neil Bush has traded in on the family name, as has his brother Jeb and as has George W., managed to, in this case, channel the money into Ignite. I don't know that these folks in Saudi Arabia or Dubai have any particular interest in Neil Bush or even in his expertise. As I said, they keep inviting him over there to speak at conferences. But I think it's more the question of what kind of favor they can curry with the current administration. Maybe future administrations if Jeb chooses to run.
Can you talk about the unusual circumstance of Neil Bush lobbying the Bush administration?
Well, that is an unusual circumstance, and he claims that that's not what he's doing, that the company will rise and fall on its own merits. But if you look at his history, his companies have never risen. They fell, but they've never risen on their own merits. And so those are, I think, dubious claims that Neil makes. But one thing about Neil Bush, I think, that separates him from the other brothers, at least in my research about it, is that he is quite a silver-tongued fellow, and that when he talks, people tend to listen. So although he was early on in his life, he suffered from dyslexia, and that's what he claims Ignite is partially about. He has been able to convince people through both his conversational abilities and his family connections to move forward with him in various and sundry business activities.
We're also joined by Stan Karp, who is editor of the newspaper of the magazine Rethinking Schools, has been a teacher for 28 years, currently teaches at John F. Kennedy High School in New Jersey. Can you put this all in the context of the bill, No Child Left Behind, and where educational software, where these private companies fit into this education bill, this law that has been passed?
Sure. The No Child Left Behind Act was passed a few months after 9/11 with overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress, both houses of Congress. And it's a dramatic change in federal education policy. Technically, it was a reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1960s, which represented the historic federal policies of trying to expand access and equity in education. This bill is a dramatic change in federal policy in a number of ways. In some ways, it sort of marries the privatization agenda of the conservatives and the standards and testing agenda of the business roundtables and the governor's education summits of the past 10 years. And it imposes, it's a dramatic extension of federal control over local schools through a testing regime that does open up many holes to the education market, which is a $500 billion market, even though the federal government only supplies about 7% of all education funding. And even though this law is underfunded on its own terms and falls very short of what would be needed to reach its unrealistic and underfunded mandates, it does in a number of ways provide opportunities for profiteering by corporations.
And Stan, historically, the Republicans have always represented getting the government out of local education. And in fact, at one point, several years back, wanted to eliminate the Federal Department of Education. Yet now we have President Bush leading an unprecedented extension of federal power into what the local schools in the country are doing.
Right, and that's one of the reasons the law is running into incredible amount of blowback, because of the breadth of the constituencies who have been alienated by this law. It's a bad law for schools, it's a bad law for teachers, it's a bad law in many respects for parents, and it's certainly a bad law for states who are facing hard budget times and are now facing very strict mandates that would be cost many billions of dollars more to meet than they can possibly fund at the levels at which they are currently funding education. There are a number of places where corporations in particular have attempted to profit from the law. One is simply the publishers of the tests. This law dramatically increases the number of tests that schools may give. And the educational implications of that are actually much more serious than the corruptive corporate influence implications of that. But it is true that, for example, the McGraw-Hill company, which has very close and historic ties to the Bush family in particular, benefited in Texas from the Bush education plan, which required certain reading curricula to be adopted that included McGraw-Hill products like the Open Court reading series and the Distar reading series. There's an estimated increase of almost 200 tests, state tests, that would have to be given as a result of No Child Left Behind, which could cost as much as $7 billion in terms of the testing profits to be made from that. And then there are certain aspects of the law which open the door to privatization. There are ways in which the testing sanctions open up schools to requirements to allow supplemental tutorial funders services to be provided by private companies and very other similar other kinds of privatization steps.
We're also joined by Bill Graves, who is a Republican legislator from Oklahoma, who is opposed to the No Child Left Behind Act. It passed overwhelmingly, Republicans and Democrats in the Congress. Why are you opposed?
Well, for one thing, the Constitution makes no gives Congress no power to legislate as to education. That's not part of the enumerated powers of Congress under Article 1, and the Founding Fathers saw fit to leave that all that matter to the states. And I oppose having people or bureaucrats in Washington dictate how we run our schools, and that's what we're getting the point to. And it's increased education spending tremendously. In 2001, the Department of Education was spending $29 billion. In 2004, it's $62 billion, and it's foreseen it's going to be in, by 2005, $64 billion. So we're spending a lot of money, And we ought to leave all that matter to the states, in my opinion. That's what, and you know, I've also heard, even though notwithstanding spending all the money, there's a lot of states aren't getting the money that they're supposed to do it, and that's why a lot of them are wanting to get out of No Child Left Behind.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves, and we'll come back with this discussion. We'll also be joined by Howard Fuller, who is with the Black Alliance for Education Options in Milwaukee, distinguished professor of education at Marquette University. Stay with us.
Teach the children, save the nation. I see destruction, the situations. They're corrupting and time's up soon. But they'll blow it up and prepare life on the moon. Sounds like total recall, but who got a spaceship? You get it, we fall. So hope for the best and expect the worst. The end is near and it's you and I first. The ones that interfere with nature, labeled you limited and under racial. His plans overruled when he separates you. Now it's you and I first, the one that hates you. So we gotta let him know we're heading to the script. Change the skit, but we're about to flip. Cause we want access to happiness, living the good life and much success. Equal opportunity, self-awareness and unity. Education, the kids need a sculpture. Teaching the app for cause and their culture. And that'll help stop the robbing, raping and killing. Poison neighborhoods are illin'. But they import more keys from across seas. The drug disease hits the streets with ease. So keep on building, cause we gotta keep building till the answers are filled in. And make sure you don't stop till then. And if you do, remember the children.
Eric B. and Rakim teach the children. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to ask a question to Bill Graves, a Republican legislator from Oklahoma, as we're continuing the discussion about the No Child Left Behind Act. I understand that some of the criticism has been that, on the one hand, there are all of these new federal mandates, especially in terms of testing and standards, but at the same time, many of the states are being burdened with having to have these tests, but not necessarily with the resources to be able to then deal with the children who are falling behind or are not meeting standards, and that this is sparking quite a bit of revolt, bipartisan revolt in a number of states. So your perspective from Oklahoma.
Well, I think that's true. In our legislature, we had a resolution asking Congress to make some changes in it because of some of the things that you've mentioned. And you know, I think not so much the funding is a problem in Oklahoma, as I understand it, but some of the requirements are seen to be as overly stringent, unworkable, or unrealistic, and that's particularly true as regard to testing as to English and as for disabled students, is what, at least that's according to the report put out by the Center on Education Policy in Washington.
I wanted to bring in Howard Fuller with the Black Alliance for Education Options, a professor at Marquette University in Milwaukee, former superintendent of the Milwaukee Public Schools. You are a supporter of the No Child Left Behind Act, as the majority of Republicans and Democrats were in Congress who passed this. Can you talk about why you like it?
Well, first of all, I didn't know I was supposed to talk about that, but since I'm on the line, I will. Our organization actually supports the provisions in No Child Left Behind that have to do with parental choice. In particular, we think the right of parents to ask to get out of schools that are not making progress, and their ability also to use supplementary educational services as an option. You know, that's what we support. We do think that it's important that we are finally having a light kind of shine on schools that are supposed to be great schools, but they're not serving certain populations very well. So from our standpoint, while we also have certain concerns about No Child Left Behind, we think the fact that people are now being told what it is that's happening to Black and Latino and poor children in some of these schools is a very important thing.
Stan Carr.
You know, one of the problems with No Child Left Behind is, frankly, that right now the administration, which is supposed to be responsible for improving public education, is filled with people who have made a career of opposing public education. Secretary Page, Undersecretary Eugene Hickok, Nina Rees, lots of people like Mr. Fuller have come into responsible positions around public education, actually supporting vouchers and the desire to privatize
public education.
Just one at a time. Howard Fuller, your response to that.
Well, what I'm saying is, I don't even know who this guy is.
Stan Karp is the editor of Rethinking Schools.
Yeah, well, he's talking about the fact that I oppose public education because I support options for parents. My view is that public education and the system that delivers public education are two separate things. I support a strong public education system. I also support giving parents options so that they can make choices for their children, just like rich people do. I found it interesting that he's pontificating about the fact that so-called privatization occurs because low-income parents are now able to go to tutoring that may be run by private entities. People with money have been able to do that all the time. And I don't remember him or his publication protesting the fact that rich people have the capacity to seek help for their children. Now he's talking about how terrible it is that poor parents will have that same opportunity to access some of these options for their children.
Stan Karp.
Let me give you an example of why I think this law does not help the kids in my school or children generally in public education. I teach in an urban high school in Paterson, New Jersey, and we have a small school within the school project where our students do need extra tutoring. Under the No Child Left Behind provisions for tutoring, a school which does not pass the adequate yearly progress requirements for testing cannot use federal funds under this law to tutor its own students. It must use, it must get some supplemental outside, a private provider, because, as a matter of fact, a private provider which does not even have to meet the same kind of requirements for highly qualified professional credentials that public teachers have to meet. It's similar with the choice provisions under No Child Left Behind.
Well, first of all,
if I could finish,
I'm sorry.
The choice provisions in No Child Left Behind say that any school that doesn't meet its test targets for 2 years has to use up to 20% of its funds to support transfers away from its school to some other school. It does not give the other schools that are receiving any funds to improve their educational services. It does not allow the kids in Paterson, New Jersey, to cross suburban lines and go to the schools in Wayne, New Jersey, or Ridgewood, or in the suburbs. And it doesn't build any new schools in those districts that are struggling and failing. So it supports choice basically to support a demand for placements that don't exist and to generate this demand for voucher systems, which will hurt public education by taking resources and students out of the schools that need the most.
Well, first of all, it's not true that you cannot have the schools where the kids are not already being well served, that those teachers can in fact provide supplementary educational services at night. I don't know what they do in your district, but in Milwaukee, most of the places that are providing supplementary educational services are the schools that the kids are in. And so, as a matter of fact, there are people who are concerned that some of the teachers who don't serve the kids well during the day now get a chance to not serve them well at night. I happen to think that that's not true, that there are schools in Milwaukee public schools that are providing supplementary educational services for the very kids that they have during the day. So I don't know why it operates that way in your district. It doesn't operate that way in Milwaukee.
Well, Mr. Fuller, I'd like to ask you, in terms of this whole issue of the best approach to dealing with children, African-American, Latino, minority children, poor children in the inner city schools, isn't most of the recommendations of educators that the principal determiner of whether you can have success in the public schools or in any school is class size, the number of children that a teacher has a responsibility for being for having to teach on a daily basis, and that the biggest problem has been the disinvestment at the state level, obviously, because a public education is run at the state level predominantly, by the states in the urban public schools?
Well, see, I think what is happening here is that you just asked me two separate questions. The fact of the matter is that there is research that shows that small class sizes benefit kids, and in particular they benefit kids in the early elementary school levels. The research is mixed on what is the impact overall? But intuitively, most people, and I would agree, you would want children in smaller class sizes. In fact, I really think we should be talking about, particularly at the high school level, smaller schools, not just smaller class sizes. The second thing that I would argue is that if you get smaller class sizes and you have people treating kids and teaching them in the same way, the fact that the classes are smaller in and of themselves won't mean that kids are going to benefit. But it is true, and it is important, that we have smaller class sizes. The issue of disinvestment, as you call it, in public schools is another issue. It's an issue related to, and I happen to think that kids in poor areas don't get the amount of money that they ought to have. But you have certain cities where you're paying $10,000, $12,000 per student, and we're still not getting academic achievement. So for me, it is an issue of the right amount of resources, but it's also how those resources get used. And I happen to think that we ought to be able to provide policies that allow dollars to follow students and give parents options to find other schools, both public and private, that will work for their children.
Yes, Dan.
One of the problems with No Child Left Behind is the sanctions that it imposes on schools for low test scores have no record of improvement of success as school improvement strategies. There's no record of improvement with vouchers. There's no record of improvement with the drastic wholesale replacement of school staff called reconstitution. The imposition of private management on public schools, which is another sanction that NCLB imposes on schools.
One at a time.
If I could just finish. In fact, they're not even educational strategies at all. They're political strategies to bring a kind of market reform to public education. And many of us fear that this is going to increase inequality in education, just like it's increased inequality in healthcare and housing, not reduce it.
You know, you talk about political strategies. You must think that we're stupid. If you think that we're going to sit here and allow you to act as if the NEA, other unions, and people like you don't have a political strategy.
You mean teachers?
Everybody has political strategies in education. The issue is in whose interest. And I would argue that it's in the interest of low-income parents for them to have choice, for them to have options, for them to have the same choices, the same options that people with money have. And for people like you to continue to argue that for those options to occur, that people are opposed to education, is just simply not true. And to say that there's no information anywhere that shows that people benefit by choice is also not true. Because if you know, and I assume that you do, you know that there are studies out there that in fact show that there have been improvements, and there are studies that debate that. Because the one thing that happens in America is anytime you put out any study, whoever opposes it is going to come out with another study that says that it's not true. So that there are studies out there that show improvement, particularly for African-American kids and low-income children who are taking advantage of various aspects of choice.
But Mr. Fuld, what about this whole issue of that is a central part of the No Child Left Behind Act, of this increasing emphasis on testing, especially high-stakes testing, as a means of determining progress in education? There are some who are criticizing this as basically determining a rote approach to learning, preparing just to take tests in the schools, and not developing learning and education as a creative experience. What's your perspective on that?
Well, first of all, I have concerns about the testing. My concern actually has to do more with the lack of being able to show value added. What I mean by that is when I was superintendent, I would sit down with teachers, third grade teachers, who would talk to me about the fact that they might get a kid at the beginning of the year who was a non-reader, and they may do a hell of a job and get that kid up to, say, a second grade level in a year, but they were still bombed on the third grade reading test because there was no way to show the value that they added in that year. And I think that that's wrong, because I think that there are teachers out there who are doing extremely good jobs at kids who have a lot of issues, but you're not able to overcome all of that in a year. And so one of the concerns that I've had, and I've expressed that to the secretary and others, is about not being able to show value added. The second problem that I have is that with the way that the regiment is set up, it's kind of a disincentive for people to start schools and take kids who are way behind, because you're not going to be able to catch those kids up in a year or two, and so you will automatically get on the list. I think that that's a problem for new schools. I think it's also a problem for schools in the public system who have a lot of kids who are way behind.
I wanted to bring one more person to this conversation, an investigative journalist named Phil Wiledo, who has been looking at the role of foundations in the whole shift toward privatizing education.
Excuse me, I have a 8 o'clock conference call, so I have to leave. But I appreciate you all allowing me to be on.
Thank you very much, Howard Fuller, Black Alliance for Education Options.
In regard to the matter of choice, The law, No Child Left Behind, provides if a student fails for two consecutive years, they can put the child in another public school or charter school, but not in a private or religious school. And I think that's wrong. That's taking away choice. And, you know, the private schools have done great in teaching kids, especially because they utilize phonics, particularly in teaching reading and that sort of thing. So this is a setback for real choice in education.
Well, let me bring Phil Wiledo into this conversation, investigative journalist. Can you talk about the role of private foundations?
Sure, and thanks very much for inviting me in a discussion. I'm sorry that Mr. Fuller had to leave. I would have appreciated talking with him directly. And Mr. Fuller, I really want to say, as someone who I lived in the city from 94 to 2000, and Mr. Fuller has a long record of devotion to the school children of Milwaukee. I disagree with his present stance on things, but people would have a hard time arguing that he doesn't have the best interest of African-American children, particularly at heart. But he made a comment which I thought was very interesting. He said the real question about the No Child Left Behind bill is in whose interest. And to answer that question, I think you have to look at the organizations and foundations that have invested a tremendous amount of money in the school voucher program. Now, Wisconsin, of course, and Milwaukee in particular, is the birthplace of the voucher movement. And there's a quote here from a report by People for the American Way of Mr. John Benson, a former Wisconsin school superintendent, who said that the voucher program in Milwaukee would never have started if it were not for Michael Joyce, president of the Bradley Foundation, until July 2001. Joyce was, quote, the firepower behind the voucher initiative. He's the one who fired up and then convinced the then-governor, Tommy Thompson, about the vouchers, and without them we wouldn't have school vouchers. I remember listening to Mr. Joyce at a symposium on education sponsored by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in the mid-90s.
We just have a minute.
In which he said that public education is a socialist idea, and he did not mean it as a compliment. Mr. Joyce's foundation was the one that poured the money into the Black Alternatives for Education, Black Alliance for Educational Options that Mr. Fuller heads, as well as the Transformation for Learning, Institute for the Transformation of Learning at Marquette University. The interest that the Bradley Foundation has is privatization of the public school system, and it's using organizations like the Black Alliance in order to promote vouchers, particularly in the African-American community, when the ultimate goal of it is not only privatization, but the destruction of the public school system. And you don't have to call that rhetoric. You can just look at the writings that they themselves have produced. And Bradley, for those folks who aren't familiar with it, is the organization that funded the book The Bell Curve, Charles Murray, which argued that African-Americans are intellectually inferior to whites, funded Board Connolly's and his anti-affirmative action referendums, funded the public interest law firms that helped to overthrow affirmative action in Texas and California, funds the whole slew of right-wing organizations, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, and so on.
Well, on that note,
no friend of the Black community, and the voucher program, although it raises certain important issues that need to be discussed, ultimately it works against Black people and all working people.
Phil Wiledo, I want to thank you for being with us, author of The Feeding Trough, The Bradley Foundation, The Bell Curve, and The Real Story Behind Wisconsin's National Model for Welfare Reform. Stan Karp, editor of Rethinking Schools. Howard Fuller is the head of the Black Alliance for Education Options in Milwaukee. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.